Okay. Okay. Everybody hear me? I'm Marika Mayer. I'm quite glad to be sitting inside today as the snow is definitely getting thicker around us. I was very interested to read these passages and see how they related to each other. And also traditionally, they have often been used with a context of talking about shedding light in the darkness. But I chose to look at them a different way, and I'd like to tell you about that. I'll start by telling you it's, and I call this reveal yourself. Some of you may know that I was a radio producer at CBC for many years, CBC Radio. We'd have daily or weekly story meetings, depending on how often the show was on air, and producers were expected to bring their best ideas to the meetings. They could be tough because you'd think your idea was brilliant, only to be shot down by the others. Just as scary on occasion was having your ideas approved and on the lineup, and then you'd have to find the right people to talk about your great idea on air. At best, it was lively and collegial, but humans being humans, sometimes petty grievances got in the way and people could be sarcastic, cutting, and mean. I worked with one host, no names mentioned, who had the most lovely and warm manner on air. Listeners loved them. I quickly learned after working with them for a while that they had a very different persona off air. As I bore the brunt of their anger and mean streak, I realized that the on-air presence was a mask. The real person was behind it. I saw their true face. I was thinking about revealing your true face as I read both the passages in Psalm 27 and Matthew 4. In Psalm 27, the psalmist, with lyrical poetry, sings to God about needing to see God's beauty and power and be sheltered under their care. One thing I ask of you, Yahweh, one thing I seek, that I may dwell in your house all the days of my life, to gaze upon your beauty and meditate in your temple. To me, this is an aspiration rather than a present condition. In verse 9, the psalmist pleads with God, "Don't hide your face from me. Don't turn your faithful one away in anger. Don't reject me. Don't desert me, O God of my salvation, for you are my only help." This is not a person who is at peace. They are in anguish. And what they seek is to see the face of the Lord. The face of God is mentioned several times in the Bible. In Exodus 33, God tells Moses that he may not look at his face or he will die. Really? To look in the face of God is to die? Here's what I think. I think that what God is really saying here is that if I showed you everything that I truly am, you could no longer go on living the way that you always have. Seeing God's face is a profound spiritual concept, often meaning a direct, unmediated experience of the divine. Seeking God's face can also be understood as a metaphor for spiritual pursuit rather than literal sight. That's what the psalmist was looking for in Psalm 27, what they yearn for. In Victor Hugo's masterpiece, Les Misérables, the main character, Jean Valjean, seeks redemption for his past by helping the poor and despised with love. As Hugo wrote, "To love another person is to see the face of God." Again, really seeing someone's true face is a communication from our inner selves. When I was a kid, we always had the same benediction at church. It's from Numbers 6. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance to you and give you peace. A more modern translation ends it with, "The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace." I loved that benediction, and it always made me feel warm inside. I think there was something about God shining God's face toward me, and it is pretty appealing, isn't it? I love that we used it for our baby dedication a couple of weeks ago, and again when we wished goodbye to Gannett and Akleilu Zaire last week. The Anabaptist Community Bible comments that this blessing has been familiar to us for centuries and has often been the first verse that children memorize. I wonder what the ancients understood when they heard, "The Lord make his face shine upon you." It seems clear to me that they understood this to mean that God was being in relationship with them, and it wasn't just some abstract notion. The use of the phrase shining face was a common idiom in the ancient Near East, and it meant pleasure, approval, or delight. That comfort or delight is what the psalmist was looking for. Maybe, who knows? That's why I found it so comforting when I was young, some tribal memory. We didn't read the entirety of Psalm 27 today, but it's worth your while to read it all the way through, because you'll see that the psalmist is going through a really tough time. An aside here, and thanks to Tim Schmucker for helping with this. The reason that I'm saying the psalmist rather than David, even though Psalm 27 is attributed to him, is that some or even many psalms were in fact written later than David's time, perhaps even centuries later. And some scholars think that Psalm 27 might be two different psalms mashed together, as the first part, which is of trust and love for God, the second half is lament and plea. The other thing that's interesting is that this psalm is a very personal one compared with many others that are more communal. But I'm going to set that aside and read it as written. The psalmist seems to have suffered greatly. In verses 2 and 3, they're pursued by enemies. God seems distant from them in verse 9. They're forsaken by their mother and father in verse 10 and slandered in verse 12. That's a lot. The travails in this psalm are a window into how hard life can be and how we can choose to respond. The psalmist's plea, not to make it all go away, but for God to show their face. And now we turn to Matthew. It's a familiar story in some ways. It's when Jesus finds his true calling. It's about finding disciples and starting his healing ministry. And soon after, he will stand on a mount and give a sermon of blessing and teaching. But let's look at what happened just before then. John the Baptist had been baptizing with water anyone who came to him and had changed their hearts and lives. This was much to the dismay of the religious officials, of course. He must be a troublemaker. Jesus and John are described as cousins, or certainly relatives, when their mothers each become pregnant. But by most accounts, they grow up separately, only meeting again as adults. And yet, both of them had been divinely ordained to be prophets. John recognized Jesus' divinity right away, so much so that he was hesitant at first about baptizing him. But when Jesus explained it, that it had been prophesied, he went ahead and did it anyway. How special it must have been for both of them. And then at that moment, heaven was opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. Sounds like seeing the face of God. After his baptism, Jesus goes to the desert to fast for 40 days and nights. The great tempter had put him to the test while he was in the desert, offering him salvation of one sort or another. We know the end of that story, where Jesus repudiated him, but let's not assume that it was simple. I can imagine that Jesus, in human form, hungry, thirsty, and exhausted, struggled to do what was right. Doing the right thing can be tough for any of us, even for Jesus. And yet, shortly after that, Jesus hears that John has been arrested and thrown into prison. Is that what spurs him to take up his ministry and start preaching and healing? And what's the first thing that he does? He walks along a shoreline. He sees some fishers and invites them to drop their nets and join him. On a side note, I was reading recently that there's a good reason to think that many of the disciples Jesus called were probably teenagers, or at least very young men when they first joined Jesus. Is that why they so readily followed him? Stop for a minute and think about it. You're at work in the family business, and this guy comes up to you and asks you to leave without goodbyes and to just simply follow him. Would you do it? Well, I know I wouldn't, or at least not that easily. Of course, this is Jesus we're talking about, and I'm guessing that those fishers recognized something in his face that reflected the face of God. Maybe they'd already heard stories about him. Maybe he had an air of authority that spoke to them. Maybe he had a presence that was so godly, so special, that they immediately got up, left what they were doing, and followed him. I wonder what their friends and family thought. What would you think if someone close to you did something like that? I know I'd be terrified if it was one of my sons, and with good reason. Things didn't work out so well for any of them, John the Baptist, the disciples, or Jesus. They were almost all executed in one way or another, although whether that's historically accurate is disputed by some. In any case, it does demonstrate great faith and belief. In our day and age, Jesus still calls us to follow him, but I'm thinking that not all of us can be quite as radical as leaving our homes, families, and friends behind to go somewhere else. We don't all need to go to the poorest places and minister, but all of us are called to live a life for God and neighbor right where we are in the context in which we find ourselves right now. All through this journey, we are reminded to look for the face of God and recognize divinity. I think we can see the face of God in many ways. Not all of us are blessed to have a visitation or a dream or a voice. I, for one, have never experienced that, although I've longed for it. I can find the face of God in the beauty I see in the world, the kindness and good that I see in people close to me and far away, and in the very fact that I'm alive right here and right now. Jesus looked at the face of God and saw what he must do to respond with love and action. We must attempt to do the same. That CBC host I talked about at the beginning ended up forcing me out of my job and the show that I loved. I felt angry and resentful for a long time. But with a lot of prayer and reflection, I came to understand that seeing someone's true face is a gift that allows you to respond in an honest way, even if that means walking away from them. I also came to consider that their pain was probably more profound than mine, as of course the same thing happened with the next producer and the one after that, too. I didn't need to interact with them, but I could still treat them with a degree of compassion and forgiveness. And my goal became to be as authentic a person as I could be, that my outside face would as often as possible be the same as my inside self. That doesn't mean blurting out everything that comes to mind immediately, what I'm thinking, but it does mean staying away from gossip, speculation, and nasty thoughts, and instead striving to be kind and generous and giving. I challenge all of us to try and look for the face of God in the coming week. Places that I have found God recently is with the Venerable Buddhist monks Walk for Peace from Texas to Washington. They ask for nothing, but they receive so much love and support, and I see them inspiring hope at a time that we desperately need it. If you're not familiar with the story, with their walk, it's worth looking it up online because I have found them truly inspiring. So let me end with the words from the monks. May loving kindness flow freely from your heart today to those who are easy to love and to those who challenge you, to strangers whose paths briefly cross yours, and most tenderly to yourself. May you and all beings be well, happy, and at peace. And may the face of God shine upon you and be gracious to you. Amen.
Let's spend a minute in quiet reflection before we sing our next song.